We've heard that Europe and Japan are spending similar amounts, and then there's a fourth category of other that is spending an equivalent amount. So who's in there? Well, that's the rest of Asia, Israel, India, those folks. China has a big cost advantage here of about a factor of six in terms of labor, which is labor is where the big costs are. I think we're going to need to watch and see what happens there, but they're pretty ambitious. As you know, they have their own space program. They're really filling their oats technologically. I think we can expect a lot of action there. Similar amounts are being spent in the private sector. People ask for numbers. All these numbers you have to take with a grain of salt since the definition is so vague. There's been a lot of relabeling, and so if you gave me a number, I could probably justify it for you. So time frames. This is really the way to get oriented. You have to look at near-term, mid-term, and long-term, where the cutoff between mid-term and long-term is a variable depending on focus and funding. In the near-term, 1 to 5 years, this stuff is pretty well understood, really. It's mostly about improved materials. We've heard some of that. You can use standard industry information sources that you can get from people like the Nano Business Alliance, Scientifica, Forbes, Wolf, these kinds of people. The benefits, both the benefits and the challenges are relatively modest compared to the longer term. No surprise there. The nanoparticles you hear a lot about, they do have new properties and they need to be treated as new entities from a regulatory perspective. But I would say by the existing agencies, one in particular activist group is calling for a new regulatory regime. I just haven't heard anybody else say that's necessary. We have lots of government agencies already that deal with safety issues, and I think they will step up to that, but it's taking some time for that to happen. But to look at it from a positive perspective, this process is starting earlier, a lot earlier, than with previous innovations. So we can be pleased about that. So I've just thrown up a list of near-term products. I put the two sexiest ones right at the front, and then it kind of goes downhill from there. Lots of money to be made, but again, not the third industrial revolution. Also not an integrated industry. You'll hear this term nanotechnology industry. This is a useful term when dealing with government, and it's a useful term when you design conferences. And I think there's a reason to have those conferences. And to use that term when dealing with government. But certainly from an investor point of view, you don't want to think of it that way. It's definitely not a coherent industry in the way that information technology hangs together. I mentioned the issue of nanoparticles. This is really just one sector of nanotechnology, even in the near term. But this is what's getting all the attention. We heard earlier about the sexiest application I've heard is the medical application where they coat these, take glass nanoparticles, coat them with gold. Sometimes they add some biological functionality, which makes them bind to tumor cells, and then you can heat them with radiation to kill the cancer. This is very sexy. I think it's been shown in animal models, and it's so sexy, I hope it gets a fast track through the approval process. Just recently, there's been some work, I believe it came out of Rice, showing that you can control the toxicity of these nanoparticles by designing them, what kind of functionality they have. This is not really a surprise because the functionality is what's on the surface, and the surface is what touches everything else. So it's not really a surprise, but it's good news for nanoparticles because people are nervous about this toxicity, and this gives you a kind of a dial that you can turn to either get it, which you want in the case of treating cancer, or turn it down for pretty much everything else. I mentioned we have the regulatory agencies in place, but the process is taking a while. To anyone with a technical background, you look at this process and go, what is the problem here? Why can't we speed this up? But the more interaction you have with Washington, you find out why that is, so it's just going to take some time. Basically, we need to think of these things as new chemicals and regulate them appropriately. These near-term results, the up 1 to 5 years, this is not deeply new stuff. It's chemistry and material science marching on as they have been doing for 100 years or more. We're slowly seeing the convergence of top-down, like nanolithography. Intel's routinely down into the under 100 nanometer range, just using top-down processes, and the bottom-up miniaturization, which is building from individual molecules coming together. Eventually these will meet. We're nowhere near having them meet yet, but it's coming along. So this is just continuation of work we've seen for a long time. Great stuff, but not the third industrial revolution. So time frames, midterm, 5 to X years. I've listed some things: sensors, actuators, active materials, molecular electronics, and targeted drug delivery. It's really hard to get reliable information about this time frame, which is really annoying. To get a feel for the kinds of things you can expect in this time frame, you can go and look at the Institute for Soldier Nanotechnologies at MIT. They are willing to make some public statements about what the kinds of things they're projecting for this time frame. My favorite one that they talk about are these soldier boots that would let a soldier, or presumably the rest of us, jump 20 feet in the air. Now that sounds really cool. So I'm looking forward to that. Just think of the new sports opportunities. But why is it so hard to find reliable information? Well, number one, it's really hard to figure out what's going to happen. But the people who think about this stuff don't want to talk about it. And the reason is, if you're in a company, you don't want to overpromise. If you're in the military, maybe you don't want to talk about it for security reasons. If you're in academia, it's discouraged to overpromise. Also, it's a problem of overpromising. So it's very, even the folks who have ideas do not necessarily share them. So it's very frustrating for those of you who are in the forecasting business, and I know a lot of you have to do that beyond 5 years. Very frustrating to try to look at this time frame. Most distressing is, even if you can get a list of what's coming, and you could probably come up with something, the order of the arrival dates is very unclear, and it makes a huge difference economically. So in this period, we've got important economic and some strategic changes, but it's not a deeply revolutionary period. So long-term, beyond X years, it's so counterintuitive, but this period is actually easier to project than the midterm. Definitely not what you'd expect. The reason is that out in this time frame, you start to say, oh, heck, let's just look at the laws of physics. Let's not try to figure out what this company is going to do or what this government agency is going to do in the near term and how funding is going to go. Let's just say, what can be done? What can be done from a physical point of view here? And once you're in that range, you have some rules you can follow and come up with some projections that seem plausible. The main reaction people who go through this process, technical people go through this process, have when they do these projections is, wow, this changes everything. You can, and I'm going to sketch out what that means, what do we mean by everything. But if you have a group of technical people who can all come to a similar conclusion, that's going to have anticipation effects. And we're seeing those already. One thing that we can be sure of, I think, is that eventually there's going to be a race to reach the specific systems engineering development goal that's being foreseen. The timing, because this is not about pure science. In pure science, you can't project things. If you could, you'd already know the science that you're trying to discover. It's inherently impossible. But that's not what this is. This is engineering. You can make projections. You may do them wrong. You may get the numbers off by an order of magnitude. But you can do them because the science underlying them is understood. So the timing of X, where we hit this particular change, will, because it's an engineering project, it will depend both on the funding and the focus of the project. And you'll see, I'm going to try to sketch and convince you that this is not a race that one can afford to lose. And you say, well, who's won? Well, whoever it is that you're thinking about. If you think about the United States, you're thinking we have people from other countries. This is something that each nation has to really think about. So how do you do it? I mentioned the laws of physics. The laws of economics, we know they push toward smaller, cheaper, faster. Laws of human nature, what I mean by that is I know a lot of engineers, and they engineer as an artist creates art. They do it because they love it, and you can't stop them from doing it. We'll talk a little bit later about whether this particular development could be stopped. I don't think so. Eventually, you reach technological advance to the limits allowed by nature, but there's no way to get a time estimate on this. What you do get is a sketch of what's coming, which is what some people call fourth generation nanotechnology. Well, the assumption is we're now in second generation, and that generation is nanoscale productive systems. I'm going to go very fast here because most of you saw this previously, molecular manufacturing, which is, it's really a new way of thinking about matter, and I'm not sure anybody made that really clear. Look around you. Look, almost everything we see here, other than the human beings here, is an artificial system. We built this. Everything, right? This thing, and this thing, this thing, the whole thing. And then there are bodies, not artificial systems, but that they're all made, everything in the room, including our bodies, depends on how the matter is arranged, which means if you get good at that, it all changes, okay? That's everything physical. So what's the big deal? Today, you can have atomic precision in your physical products, but they have to be really small because that's what chemists do. They make molecules. They're wonderfully atomic precise, and they're just really small. Or you can have large, complex structures. You can have helicopters and battleships, but they are not atomically precise. Computers are not atomically precise. Nothing except what the chemists do is atomically precise today. But you really want both at the same time. You want the large size and the precision. If you could get that direct control down to the molecular level, not this indirect control we have today, you could change and repair the structure of all physical things. Contingent, of course, as always, on the software, which is going to be a big issue. But we would include the human body in that list of physical things that could be changed. So how do you do it? Molecular machines, we've heard quite a bit about it, about those at this meeting, so I'm going to zip through this for the new people. They're found in nature, but we're talking about designing new ones and building new ones. We want to be able to use these nanosystems for manufacturing complex, atomically precise products of any size. We're not talking about small things here. You've seen, most of you have seen these pictures, a differential gear. You're looking inside. These are not artist conceptions. These are based on the best chemistry software available. This is the tip of a robotic arm, 6 degree of freedom robotic arm. You've got to have that if you really want that control. You've seen this bearing model, the rotation. And I think you've seen this. This is a planetary gear. It's a cutaway. And if I click on it, it's supposed to move. There you go. This is so you're seeing part of it and how that works. Again, this is not an artist's conception. This is based on our best understanding of physical principles. So what do you get? Well, you know, Michael Crichton likes to talk about these little things that are scary, that use these machines. We like to talk about the nanofactories, basically bringing the building of products. We know how to build products automatically, build it down to the nanoscale. We also saw in that movie, that wonderful movie, how do you get big stuff? Because it would take forever building one molecule at a time to get something big. You've got to use massive parallelism. You've got to have things come together in kind of an exponential fashion, convergent assembly. We saw it in the movie. If any of you haven't seen the movie, you definitely want to see that. So you get extreme decrease in direct costs, manufacturing costs, because we see that through systems of molecular machines. They don't use labor. Once they're built, they just keep going. That does not include insurance costs, legal, IP licensing costs. I know we have a lot of attorneys here, so I just want to reassure you that your jobs are secure. In fact, you guys should really, really prosper in this new world. This type of manufacturing is extremely clean intrinsically. And you should be able to make much more complex devices, which throws us back into the software problem. Where do we use them? This is what we talked about yesterday, medicine, environmental, affordable, clean manufacturing, clean water, energy resources, transportation, space. We had a surveillance debate yesterday, which is the downside of these sensing technologies. Crime reduction would be the benefit. The benefit would be national, really good defense technologies. The downside is offensive technologies coming from this powerful change. Basically, as I mentioned, all physical technologies are potentially affected by this. This is what we mean by the third industrial revolution. When you hear that phrase, they're talking about, or they should be in my view, talking about this stage of nanotechnology, not the nanopowders. They're just not that exciting. What's the timing? Everybody wants to know, what's that X number? Well, it's based on an engineering program, which hasn't yet been funded, right? So we have no clue. I mean, we can make guesses. If we got extremely excited, which I don't think is going to happen today, I can imagine 10 to 15 years, to 15 years is kind of getting more plausible. If we just kind of futzed around and really didn't aim at it, this thing could kind of happen in 25 years. But I don't think that's going to happen, because there are military applications here, big military applications. And I don't think that the U.S. military and the various other militaries around the world are just going to sit on their hands and watch this thing coming. Now, we, as Foresight Institute, would prefer a civilian program based in one of the democracies or a group effort of democracies. So what are some opportunities for tweaking this revolution? You heard about the Millennium Challenges yesterday. We feel that that's a way to focus this revolution in a positive direction. And I'm going to sketch how nanotechnology can help on the various challenges. And then we have some near-term policy options, things we can do today to make this happen in a better way. Here are the Millennium Challenges. I believe there are 15 Millennium Challenges. Foresight has said we think nanotech can help with 8 out of the 15. That's pretty good. Now, the next few slides are based on a talk I gave on Thursday. They're in here mainly to give you a feel for what the power of this for the Millennium Challenges. And as I mentioned, this is going up on the web, so I'm going to move fast. But if you're interested in these specific applications, you can see that when the talk goes up on the web. So I'm going to move fast now. Clean water. We heard from Gail Pergamit yesterday some very near-term things that can happen for clean water. Very exciting work. Certainly, if the problem isn't solved by Gail and her company, her various companies, we should be able to nail it at this stage of nanotechnology. Resource issues totally change. Being able to, the whole mining thing and how filthy dirty it is, you may be aware of that. That just changes. Instead, you can use direct molecular separation. Much cleaner. Metals. What are we using? Do we even have to mine metals at all? And the answer is, well, you know, they're just not that useful. If you can build with this new technology, you end up using carbon. Where do you find carbon and where do you find silicates? They're in the rocks, okay? So it's not like you have to dig through massive amounts of material to find veins of very unusual stuff. That ends. I'm sure, obviously, metals will continue to be useful in some cases, but it's not a strong material. Fuel cells, okay. How many of you feel comfortable that you know what a fuel cell is? You know. That's wonderful, because up until recently, I was a little vague on what fuel cell is. So the rest of you, I'm going to try to take a shot at explaining it, and those of you who raised your hands, I'm sure will yell out if I get it wrong. Today, we burn fuel. But it turns out that's, and this is very bizarre if you're not used to the idea, that's not the most efficient way to remove the energy from the fuel. Instead, you combine the fuel and the oxidizer without burning. Is that right, Tom? Did I get that right? Chemically. Well, burning is chemical. Never mind. We're not going down there. So the point is, this is great stuff, I'm told, and it's much more efficient for energy. Solar, geothermal, all these things become possible. Getting away from the moving parts of our energy systems. Strong materials we heard about yesterday make a difference for space transportation. Many of us who are into nanotechnology also care a lot about what happens with the space frontier. This makes near-Earth space access much more possible. So sustainable development is one of the challenges. I mentioned that this type of manufacturing is extremely clean. We're talking bottom-up, massively parallel. You see there's quotes around the zero waste. Technical people sometimes get upset by this. I think they mean by this term is that you're not wasting molecules. We all know that the laws of physics tell us that there's always a little waste heat. There's no way around that. But you can be extremely energy efficient. Another of the challenges is information and communication technology for all. We've got to get the cost down for that to happen. Molecular manufacturing ought to make the cost of manufacturing down, and I mean the direct costs again, not the legal costs, down to the level of, say, another product created by molecular machines, potatoes. I would like us to consider the possible open source approaches to the intellectual property issue. Because at the top it says for all, and I mention various legal costs, especially IP licensing. If we want these things to be very affordable very quickly, we want to consider possible open source IP regimes for some of this technology. Another challenge is reducing ethnic conflict, terrorism, and weapons of mass destruction. I mean, in some sense, these are social problems, but technology can help in terms of detecting these things, communicating their presence. Right now, when you come through, I just came into the country, the way they detect these things is with dog noses. Now, dog noses are very good, but there's limitations on a dog nose. So who knows? What if he has a cold today and we don't know about it? But abuse of this sensing technology is the U.S. public's greatest concern currently for potential problems coming from nanotechnology. That's the top of the list for things people are worried about, and that's legitimate. We talked yesterday about medical applications. I'm going to zip along. This is the science fiction-y looking nanorobot illustration, but I think something like this will be happening. So how do you speed this up? I think obviously it's clear that we at Foresight feel nanotechnology can make a huge difference and that the greatest leverage area is through molecular machine systems. So how do you speed them up? Some near-term policy options. Well, the good news is, at least in the U.S., nanotech has bipartisan support. There aren't really any opponents of this stuff at this time. The main thing that we're calling for is a targeted program for molecular machine systems. The reason you need that is that the current NNI goals are really, really broad, and nobody would argue that they're not good things. But if you want this huge payoff for molecular machine systems, it's an engineering challenge. You don't get engineering things happening by accident. You need a targeted program, and this is very ambitious. When the NNI was promoted to Congress, this goal was used as part of the justification. We had Ralph Merkel come in. He did the he presented. He made the case that we needed to do this. But, you know, we don't have this targeted R&D program happening today. So, you know, I've just pulled from air a number of what fraction of NNI funding that I think should go into this. Actually, if it was up to me, I'd make it much higher, but I'm trying to be a little bit realistic here. And there's nothing magical about these numbers. The main thing is to have a number, to have a program. It's not that there's nothing relevant happening. There are relevant things being funded already, but they're not being coordinated. And to get an engineering system to work, those of you who do engineering know, you need that to work. You know, you can't have a gear over here and another part of the system over there, and these folks aren't talking. These aren't going to work together. So we need some focus there. Private industry could do more. One thing that would help, we feel, is my understanding is that the current R&D tax credit keeps expiring and they have to keep renewing it. Well, that's kind of hard if what you're doing is long-term work. Whoever's doing that in private industry needs some reassurance that these kinds of things are actually going to continue. So I would say our suggestion is, look, just make the thing permanent. Now, is this just for nanotechnology? No. This would be for technology across the board. I would argue it's a good thing. I mentioned we need some intellectual property improvements. Those of you familiar with the patent system, at least if you're a technical person, often realize that there are problems. Nanotech is interdisciplinary. It's very challenging to understand. The patent office is funded by user fees, but those user fees are drained away. And we heard yesterday, I didn't know the numbers, but we heard someone in the audience gave the numbers of the money that goes in and the money that remains in the patent office. And those numbers are outrageous. Huge amounts of money go in, and most of it, if I understood, is the vast majority gets drained away. Well, no wonder the patent examiners have so little time. I have 6 hours here. I've heard it's down possibly to as low as four. Compare that to the legion of attorneys on the private sector who are submitting this and the hundreds of hours that go into preparing this thing. It's just an imbalance in the system. And there's just no way these examiners, no matter how good they may be, are going to make the right decisions. They're going to give patents that shouldn't be issued. They're going to give overly broad patents. They're going to patent things that are well-known standard practices. This has happened in other industries. And this is a disaster. So we just basically need to end this diversion. I know Nano Business Alliance is calling for this. The IEEE is calling for this. Certainly we are calling for this. This just has to stop. This is a mess. There's a funding gap. Those of you who've ever tried to do a commercialization, the only way to get the cost down for the average person is good commercialization. The government does not, researchers and the government do not bring costs down for the public. That's not how it happens. You've got to commercialize. So how do you make that happen? You've got to somehow get from the research to a product proposal that venture capital can fund. And there's a huge gap there. Right now, companies are told, oh, go get a DARPA grant. Well, DARPA and the SBIR program can't do it all. Mike Honda has some proposals here, and I'm going to speed up because I'm really getting low on time. These are all be on the web. There's some specific legislation that Mike Honda is proposing. John Sweeney has some ideas for improving the quantity of U.S. talent. Those of you who are familiar with the graduate schools in the U.S. and technical areas know that it's really dominated by foreign students, which is not a problem unless they stop coming. And they are starting to stop coming because of the visa issues that came out of 9/11. So we've got to do more homegrown talent here, and these proposals will be on the web. This is about attracting those foreign students. We've got to make it clear they're welcome here. They're welcome to stay on. They're welcome to become citizens. And we need to get that visa turnaround time continue to come down. This afternoon, you'll be hearing about the Foresight Guidelines for Responsible Development. Obviously, there are safety issues that need to be addressed. And this is our current version 4.0 on how to do that. These are mainly addressed at nanotech professionals, industry, and government policy. They don't take on the whole military terrorist arms control issue. I would say we need separate guidelines for that. That's a huge, huge, huge challenge, and you're all welcome to participate in those. And there's the URL if you're interested. So ethical issues, we've got to get the costs down. That's how industry has to do that. Lowering the IP costs, we need to look at open source possibilities. I'm not suggesting overhauling the system. I'm just suggesting looking at areas where that might help. We want to prevent accidents. I've mentioned the Foresight Guidelines. In the near term, we've got our regulatory agencies. They're looking at this. They need to move a little quicker. Excuse me. And then finally, this whole arms control issue, which frankly is so daunting. We're gonna have to get a lot of help on that one. Some people would say, if this is such a dangerous, powerful technology, why are we doing it? There was a call a while back for relinquishment, quote unquote. And of course, the problem with that is relinquished to whom? This is a matter of power, economic and military power. We need stewardship. We can see it coming. I don't see any way to stop it. We need stewardship of this. We have to pick who or what kind of entity is, and maybe we have to create a new entity, it's possible, is the best steward for this. But stopping is not an option. Does it sound like science fiction? You bet. But if you're looking out in this time frame and what you see looks like science fiction, it could be wrong, but if it doesn't, you know it's wrong. Here's some resources for you, some websites. Of course, there's the next year's conference, the Vision Weekend, which is where we look at some of the more visionary sides of what's coming, and some books down here at the bottom, Engines of Creation and Unbounding the Future. They're both available free on the web, or you can buy both of them through Amazon. And a new book coming out in May by one of our speakers, Nano Future by Josh Hall. I think I've just saw the zero sign, so I'm going to stop here, and maybe we can take a couple questions. Thank you.
Well, let's do two quick questions.
Taking advantage of immediate access to the mic. You said that anticipation effects will inevitably lead to a race that one cannot afford to lose. Some of us, as you may well know, are scared of the results of these races and would like to see as many people get together and work together as possible. How do you see that we can encourage people to work together and discourage the creation of outcasts who may go off and do things on their own and create a race?
Right. Well, I think there's going to be a race, so it's more the question of how do we make that work out the best way that it can. Well, I believe what we're advocating is an open project in the democracies and among democratic countries. Ideally, it would be international. But I have to say, you know, I've gone over to Europe a few times, and I just don't think they're stepping up to this over there. I don't see that. I wish I did. I've really tried. So I'm not sure that the international thing is going to work. Maybe we can work with Japan and some Asian countries. There's Israel. The main thing we're advocating is an open program. I don't think this needs to be classified work. The U.S., at least here in the U.S., we've been through this a number of times. You've got basic research. Basic research doesn't need to be classified. And then as it marches on, eventually you get really close to some scary applications, and that's when, ideally, pretty late in that process, there's a point where the whole arms control, weapons control process kicks in. So the main thing we're trying to advocate is openness in the process. Is that a full answer? It's not really a full answer, but that's the best we've done so far.
One more question.
Thank you very much, Christine. Michael Mehta again from Canada. It seems evident that there's a big split between those people who are willing to look at the shorter medium-term applications and those who are willing to look at the long-term applications. And I'm wondering to what extent the unwillingness to look at longer-term applications affects the kinds of research that's being done or funded and the kinds of roadmaps that are being constructed.
Oh, absolutely. I think first of all, people naturally have different time horizons, and that's many, many people, I'd say most people, their time horizon is in the 1 to 2 year time frame. And these can be extremely successful people and very smart people. So there's nothing wrong with that per se, but those folks just are not going to be interested in this, and they're not going to think about it. There are people whose job it is to project out into this time frame, environmental folks, military folks, Social Security folks, those kind of people. I think it's definitely the case that that the magnitude of this revolution, and in particular the potential for abuse, is sufficiently nervous-making that some folks, including some researchers, they just do not want to think about it. They don't want to think about it. They don't want to talk about it. They especially do not want it talked about with the public. I can understand that. They're concerned about the funding issues. We understand that, and we sympathize with that, but our position is that, you know, at least in this country, it's a democracy. This research is being funded by taxpayer dollars, and you absolutely have to educate the public, or else things are going to go off the rails. Look at GMO. Or GM organisms in Europe. Mainly that fuss, I would say, is mainly based on kind of a lack of really understanding what's going on. So our position is we understand that these are difficult issues and it's uncomfortable to talk with the public about it, especially given the lack of science information. But we've been at this since 1986, and if you look at the U.S. public's understanding of nanotechnology, it's pretty darn good. They may not be able to give a definition. Heck, you know, how many of us can give a really good definition of a technical area that we don't work in? Not very rarely. But in general, if you look at their lists of where they think, what are the benefits and what are the downsides, they're excellent. And that makes me feel really good because I've been kind of spending a lot of time on that. So, yes, I totally agree that there's this nervousness about the long term. There's this avoidance of wanting to think about it. I think that's dangerous because the military doesn't have those concerns, and I think the civilian sector has to step up to it.